This is Ken Kellerman. It's September 14, 2010, and I'm with Frank Drake in Greenbank, West Virginia.
I did want to go over, because you told me this story once, but I didn't write it down. The 36 one. I know you.
36 one?
Yeah, I know you played a big role in that, getting Frank Lowe and everything.
I got Frank Lowe here, and I got the 36 one.
Yeah. But, it's got a volume meter. What you put in the book may have been a little bit exaggerated. There was an extra half a page in the annual budget request or something.
No, that's not exaggerated. annual budget request must be in the file somewhere. That was a major document.
Yeah.
Must be somewhere.
But you said that there was a spare page, so you just wrote that in. Half a page.
Yeah. That's true.
Right.
That's true.
But, I mean, surely there must have been some broader discussion, or...
There was no discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so weird. It was a last-minute thing. And it was just decided, just try it. We can't lose.
So what year was that? It was nearly complete. Yeah. The dish was at the bottom of the mountain.
Probably 62. But there was one paragraph saying we proposed to build a 36-foot millimeter dish for $1 million. With the size being... $1 million came from using a scaling law developed from the cost of various antennas as to how you could predict the cost of an antenna depending on its wavelength, minimum wavelength and size. What the minute price went is the square root of the maximum frequency and the diameter to the 2.7 power, if I remember right.
2.7, I think, is a standard number that everybody uses now, and 0.7 for the frequency.
What I used, but that, it came from such a calculation.
Yeah.
I didn't go to any manufacturer or engineer or anything. I used entirely that simple formula.
And at what point did you recruit Frank, Drake?
Frank Lowe.
How did you know about him?
How did I know about him?
He was at Texas Instruments.
Somebody, and that's what I can't remember, told me. At NRAO, we talked about we should get into millimeter wave astronomy, and about which we knew nothing. And somehow, I wish I could remember, somebody told me that there was this invention, a Texas instrument of a bolometer that would work at 1 millimeter wavelength and was very sensitive. And it had been invented by this guy, Frank Lowe. So I made a trip to Dallas and talked to him about it, and he was really interested. Brought him on a visit to Greenbank, and he agreed to come. How that works. There was no big deal there. Not a lot of coaxing or arm twisting.
Things were easy then.
Things were easy, and he wanted to. I think he was kind of fed up with the industrial ambience of Texas Instruments. And when he came, he just took over. He was ran the project.
Right.
Like he was an independent operator.
Yeah. Which he became. But did he handle the contract and the mechanical aspects and everything?
Yeah. We got him a dish.
Yeah, there was some small dishes.
It was one of the Kennedy spin cast dishes, which I think was a 6-foot dish, which got mounted on a mount just back of the... Jansky Lab. And the waveguides and feeds and stuff were all made in the lab. They were little tiny things. They were incredible. The feed would look like a soda straw.
Yeah.
And he put it all together, and we did assign him a technician. His name was Arnold.
Davidson, yeah.
Arnold Davidson. And went with him eventually when he went to
Arizona. When I came June of 65, I remember now, I asked you the other day when you left, I came for a visit in 1963 on my way to Australia.
Yeah.
And you were just leaving.
Yeah. I left in the summer of 63.
Yeah, and that's when I came.
Yeah.
And when I came in 65, Frank was already gone, and Arnold was here.
Yeah.
And Dave Heeshan, he had 2 weeks left or something. Dave Heeshan told me, he said, well, you're interested in source spectra. Learn all you can about velometers in the next 2 weeks.
did you cope with it all right?
Well, no. I mean, we had an arrangement. I mean, after the telescope was built, I would go out there and work with Arnold and Frank.
Yeah.
We never got past Saturn, I think. I mean, there was huge thermal effects in the disk. You couldn't start observing until 10 o'clock. No, I mean, until it settled down. You couldn't use it in the day, 10 o'clock at night. Just getting focused.
Yeah, and the atmosphere was probably coming and going.
Bad.
We used to, when it first came, it was midwinter, and that was pretty good then. There was very little water vapor.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Kitt Peak.
Oh, Kitt Peak.
Not here.
Oh, Kitt Peak.
The 36.
You're not talking about the 6 foot. Yeah. The 36.
Right. Foot. Yeah. So it was. So it must have been finished in 66 or something.
Yeah.
So when you came, Finley and Heeshan were here.
Yep. They were both here already. They hadn't been here long. They'd been here just 3 or 4 months.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's not long. We were all in the nut bin, as it was called.
That was the house that was right here past where the gate is now?
Yeah, and then very quickly we moved into a house that was farther up in the site, because the nut bin was a one-story place, and I could show you the house, but I can't remember the name of it. But it was two stories. The three of us were on the second floor, and on the first floor were the first two electronics technicians, Warren Waddell and Dewey Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And then soon thereafter, Groat Reaver showed up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually.
And life changed.
Well, I've heard all the stories. I got to know him pretty well, too. But,
yeah, he was a character.
Do you have some specific responsibility or area then? John was in charge of electronics, I guess. All the instrumentation.
Yeah, actually, at that time, there was no telescope. So none of us had any specific titles or anything. Later on, when the 85-foot was built, I became the director of scientific services and telescope operations. And that's when we invented this thing, which has been a great success, called the telescope operator. That was a whole new concept. Because up until then, radio astronomers all ran their telescopes themselves. And
that was essentially a copy of the night assistant.
Yeah, same thing as the night assistant, but that had not existed in radio astronomy. But since we were going to be bringing in a lot of visitors, it sounded like a good plan. Plus, we needed the help. We needed more hands. And the first one was Fred Cruz.
Right. Actually, Fred told me that's not the case.
There's somebody before him.
Yeah. I forget. Somebody we know. I forget who it was. It was only a month or something.
Yeah. Fred was there very early. Yeah. He might not have been the first. There was a guy named Tim Hankins who went there at SIBO. Omar Boyer. Those were early.
He was early. But I'm not sure if he was here before Fred.
There was George Grove, Omar Boyer, Fred Cruz. Look at a picture of the staff or something, it might ring a bell.
So there was no director then, except for Lloyd Burster.
Ongoing search for a director.
I read a lot about this, but I mean, what was the attitude here locally, I mean, about the situation?
Nobody cared much because we were getting the stuff done. We didn't need a director.
Right.
Everything was so simple. We didn't have a telescope. Yeah, yeah. We didn't have an observing program. And we did everything just sort of by consensus. And with that few people, it was easy.
You all got along well? Or
yeah, everybody.
Even with John?
He was okay. You know, he was pompous once in a while, but he was fine. And then very soon, Hayne Bottom came.
Right.
That got to be the team. And Hayne was real easy to work with. He was always cooperative.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Later on, another year, it was probably a year, then Sebastian von Horner came and Dave Hogg.
Yeah, Dave first came as a student.
If you say so.
Yeah. I talked to him.
Yeah.
You remember your number?
No, I don't, but it was a very low number.
Yeah.
It was like 4 or 5.
Okay.
Because at that time, there was the only other staff member was B.D. Sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And there was probably somebody in maintenance.
I think Berkner and Emerson had numbers.
Did they?
That's what I think Keisha said once.
Should be
able to look that up, yeah.
It was some low number, yeah. A lot of stuff got built, and I was just thinking that almost seemed like overnight the Jansky Lab appeared in the residence hall in the maintenance building.
That
was all happened.
Before you came, or?
No, that was. Exactly. When I came, there was
nothing. You said you were in the other building.
There were no new structures whatsoever. We could make it do with farmhouses.
Yeah. And were relations with the locals as sensitive as been described later?
But the deed was done. The land had been bought. The families had been evicted. That was before my time, whether they actually evicted them or whether they just paid them enough that they didn't mind. Or
Fred told me that the their farming wasn't doing very well. The structures were old.
Yeah.
And that they were not unhappy to be paid.
Yeah, I think that was the case.
Uh-huh.
As long as they got paid maybe probably more than they expected, but actually not very much. They were happy. We used to hire some of the locals to babysit our kids and such, and they were always really friendly.
Oh, yeah. I did too when I was here.
My wife taught Becky Sheets to play the piano and all that kind of stuff.
So why did you leave? It was just at the time
things were starting to go.
It was
because I'd been in Greenback 5 years. It was getting really boring. And I went on it was decided the national centers should get to know each other better or something. So we were invited to visit Kitt Peak.
Yeah, it was going on when I came. We did that that was good.
It was like a visit to another planet. There was a real town and city and restaurants and stuff. And real schools. And I gave a paper at some meeting on a radio mission for Venus, which I'd done with the 85-foot.
Right.
And some guy from JPL offered me a big position at JPL. And I thought, oh, wow. And I moved to a big city. And, big laboratory with lots of money and equipment. That was the attraction.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be a big mistake. JPL was awful.
Well, knowing what I know now, yes, that's why I asked the question, because, you know.
Yeah.
But we didn't know then, or you didn't know then.
No, I didn't. Yeah. Well, I had loved the experience at Green Bank. All the people, what we were doing, the freedom we had, it was all great. It was really great.
But the move to Charlottesville was already known then.
No.
Yes, well, when I came in 63, Dave told me about we were going to play at the Charlottesville.
I was partially responsible for that, I think, because of...
Right, oh, because you're leaving.
I was leaving, and part of that was the school was terrible in Green Bank. And I had two kids approaching school age. And this offer came from JPL. I thought, well, this sounds good. And the fact that I bailed out, I think, created the pressure for the Charlottesville move, because a lot of families were moving on.
So when I came out, I was still single, and everybody moved, and I just stayed. But by that time, the elementary school was okay.
They fixed it up later.
Yeah, and a lot of the NRAO spouses taught.
Yeah.
And so through elementary school, it was okay. Mm-hmm. In fact, you didn't have a lot of the problems you had in big cities. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as you got to the middle grades,
it wasn't good.
They offered the advanced opportunities that you get. And of course, the fraction of the local people that went on to higher education was very low. So
very low,
the whole peer pressure situation.
We
left until I was 10.
Well, same experience as mine, I guess, Yeah, I felt the family was just too limited here, and limited education, but limited everything else. Extracurricular stuff.
Yeah, but that changed, though, after a while.
It seems to be pretty good now.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks. And if you can find any... I did want to ask you about Struve.
Struve.
Oh, God.
Did you overlap with Struve?
No. So one reason when he came, he was already very old, but I realized he was a lot younger than I am now.
He didn't want to come. That was part of it. And he knew he wasn't competent. Have I told you any of that story?
No. I've read a lot.
Somewhat longer story. After all our searching for director, they recruited Joe Pausey, which was terrific. And he came here.
Yeah, I'm familiar with all that.
You know all that, with the brain tumor and all that. And, and then suddenly one day Joe Pausey's gone, and we're back at square one. No director, nobody in sight. And the AUI board was searching around for a director. And... Struve was on the board, I think.
He was on the committee. There was an external.
He was in the.
There was a committee.
He's involved in the search somehow.
Yes.
Either as a AUI board director or just a.
Yeah. There was a selection committee that was appointed.
He was on it.
I found the papers. Ira Bowen.
Yeah.
Was the chair.
Oh. Okay.
And I found his papers.
Yeah.
At the Huntington Library. So it's got all the details of that and the problems that they had and everything. And then Stuart volunteered or was drafted.
Yeah,
But what I really want to know is what it was like when he was here and 140-foot problems.
Well, which were all over his head. No, let me just tell you what he told me, why he had taken the job.
Mm-hmm.
He said he'd been on that search committee, and he saw that this, what was to be a great observatory, was in desperate need of leadership. And the statement, this is a quote, he says, I am a soldier in the Army of Astronomy, and I saw it as my duty to take on this job. because this was a very important institution to me, an experienced director. But the thing, phrase I remember was him saying, I'm a soldier in the Army of Astronomy. And then he came, and one of the I probably told you some of this stuff before, and things he said. One thing, he studied all the programs that were going on and what the telescope could observe. At that time, it was 85 foot. He discovered we could only see like 50 radio sources or something with it. And he got really upset how, you know, you can't do a lot of research if you can only see 50 things. One of his first comments was, you have to discover some variable radio sources, because then you'll have something to observe forever. That was one of his first comments. And then I actually mapped the galactic center with the 85 foot. Right. His comment on that was, oh, thank God you've justified the whole cost of that telescope, he said. Well, then the other thing he did, he missed working on stellar spectrum, optical spectrum. And so he hired Roger Lins and Beatty Lins.
Right.
Actually, to get Beatty Lins.
Oh.
Yeah, he wanted to, because she'd been his assistant.
Right.
And he wanted her as an assistant, and so they could work on some optical spectra he was going to get someplace. And so he hired, but he, you know, in those days you didn't hire the wife and not the husband. So he hired Roger as an astronomer, got Beatty as assistant to the director and librarian.
Right.
And that's, they showed up, and that made his life better, because he could talk optical spectra with Beatty, and she was working then on her Dark Nebula catalog.
Didn't he bring, I don't remember her name.
Also, yeah, there was a...
Who was his librarian or assistant?
His assistant.
She was still here when I came.
He brought her, I forget her name.
Yeah.
Beatty was to be his sort of science colleague, because the radio astronomers didn't talk the same language. And he was always really uncomfortable in meetings when we were talking megahertz and beamlets and things. He was pretty unhappy as soldier duty. He'd occasionally go off to New York for a week at a time, and never knew what he did. He just
AUI. To AUI?
No, he would go on vacation. He would go just get out of there for a week. He'd do that every few months. Just disappear for a week, he'd come back. His wife hated it. You know, we built a big house, a redwood house, mm-hmm. for him.
Oh, that was built specifically?
That was specifically for Stroob, because he was so tall and well. Well, because there wasn't a suitable director's residence, and then it was built with him specifically in mind, so everything's oversized. And I don't know if you've noticed that.
I haven't been in there in years.
Yeah. And his wife lived in the Redwood House, and she came to no social events.
I see.
Occasionally, you'd meet her walking the observatory road, you know, the one that goes down 140 foot, and she'd be in sort of a long robe. And she was like a sort of a ghost or something walking the road. She had a purple robe she'd walk in. But she didn't mix at all. She didn't come to any social events. You know, he must have been having a real tough time. So finally he moved on to Berkeley. And another directorial crisis, but by now Dave had been around long enough that he'd earned the trust and respect of the authorities in AUI, so they made him director.
I think, not from the way he tells it, Robbie.
Robbie, I was there. Robbie tapped him.
Yeah, no, but they didn't get along.
Oh.
Apparently Dave said that Robbie...
could be.
Was unhappy with the move to Charlottesville. He wanted, you know, to go to Princeton or...
Oh. And that was after my time.
Oh, yeah, it would have been. Yeah. Said he didn't speak to him for a year.
That's wonderful.
I mean, Robbie didn't speak to him today.
Yeah. But Robbie, I think think Robbie got fed up with this whole business revolving door. So I remember there was a meeting of the trustees somewhere. The reason I was there, I don't know why. Robbie just announced we're going to make Dave the director.
There's 140-foot problems.
That, you know, that really didn't affect the astronomers, that, because that was all
Pete Denson.
That was all contractors dealing directly with AUI. You know, so the Emerson and those guys were coming and going, but it didn't wash down on us at all.
I see.
We were happily doing our stuff at the 85-foot. No, we never were involved. The only way we were involved was picking the site. They asked us to decide exactly where to put it. Finley did that. He went out one day with a stake and pounded it in the ground, and that was it.
But during the 85-foot era, it wasn't really the National Observatory.
Well, it did attract a few, mainly Westerhout.
Oh yeah,
Westerhout was coming all the time. Mm-hmm. But he was really, I can't remember any other visitor, but Westerhout was real active.
He was a big user on the 300-foot.
Yeah, the whole time I was at Green Bank, Westerhout was coming and going. And
yeah, he did when I was here. A long time after I came.
Remember the time he went out, the first day he was here, he went out with his kids and was driving down the road to the Hannah house and told the story about how he saw a snake in the road. And they don't have snakes in Holland. You had to show his kids a snake. And so they stopped the car and they got out and they ran over towards the snake, and the snake ran off in the grass. He says, he came to the 85-foot where we were after this. He was telling us about this. Now we went in the grass and we actually could find the stake because it kept making this rattling sound.
I think the whole time I was here, I think I saw one rattlesnake.
Yeah.
And that wasn't on the side; it was hiking.
I never saw any, but he did.
Okay, well, thanks. Oh. And have a look if you have any...
Yeah, next time I'm looking at that stuff.